Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. I'm delighted to say we're joined once again by the great Kim Newman. Kim, welcome back.
I'm so pleased to be back after such a brief spell away.
I know. We can't get enough of you. And I'm delighted to welcome for the first time Prana Bailey Bond, who you may have heard me talk about because she is the maker of a brilliant new film called Censor, which played at the Sundance Film Festival. I understand it's an online version of Sundance, but played at Sundance. And I saw it, and it just seemed to me to be a film that was made entirely for me. And I just loved it. I thought it was terrific. I've actually seen it a few times now. And so I said, as soon as was possible, I would get Prana on, and also Kim, because this came up in a conversation that Kim and I were having before I'd seen the film, that Kim has an exec producer credit on the film. So he's been involved in the creation of it. In fact, I said to you, is it as good as I want it to be? And you said, well, I'm an exec producer, so of course the answer to that question is yes. I can now tell you very happily that it is every bit as good as I wanted it to be. So Prana, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Let me start by asking you, just outline the film for those who haven't seen it, because obviously it hasn't opened in the UK yet and won't for a little while, but just tell us what the film's about.
Okay, so it's a psychological horror called Censor, and it's set against the backdrop of video nasties, the video nasty social hysteria in the kind of early to mid 80s in the UK. And it follows a film censor who sees a film that harks back to the day her sister disappeared when she was a child. And when she investigates the film's director, the lines between fiction and reality start to blur.
If I hadn't had someone to talk to, I think I might have just, I don't know, lost it.
Why do you think he can't remember?
Who?
The amnesiac killer.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, why wouldn't he remember?
God, it's hard to... Could be basic trauma. Brain, it sort of shuts it out. Could have had a bang on the head even, or... It makes me think of my psychotherapy days. We talk about how people construct stories to cope. You'd be surprised what the human brain can edit out when it can't handle the truth.
And now, I don't know, because we've not met before. Prana, if it's not a rude question, how old are you?
I'm 37, I think. I think I'm 37. That's terrible. I was born in 1982. So, yeah.
Okay. So you were born, but you can't have been, you know, obviously you're not old enough to remember the video nasties panic as Kim and I, who lived through it as wizened old yes. warriors that we are. What was the thing that drew you to that time and that subject?
Well, being born in the 80s means, I mean, I was very young when all this was going on, so it was a very different experience for me watching these films. I wasn't kind of experiencing them in the way, say, Enid, the lead of Censor, experiences them at all. I wasn't kind of seeing the Daily Mail articles and things like that, but I did grow up watching things like The Evil Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But actually the first place I started with Censor was actually censorship and the idea of, you know, if violent images are supposed to make us commit violent acts, what is it that prevents the censor from losing control? And it started as quite a silly idea in my head, And I delved into the world of censorship, and I kind of went right back to the beginning of censorship in the UK. But the most exciting era for me is the 80s because of the moral panic around these particular films.
Let me just ask you, so how old were you when you saw like Evil Dead and Texas Chainsaw?
I think by the time I saw them, I was probably at least 13, I would say. But my first experience of censorship was actually seeing Simon Bates introduce a film, and it was a 12, and I think I was probably about 8, and we'd rented it from the video shop, and I'd never seen this guy before, Simon Bates, who'd introduced the classification, and he was sat behind this desk, you know, looking all bespectacled and in a suit and very official, and he said, it is an offence for anybody under the age of 12 to watch this film, and something about being prosecuted. And I was completely terrified, and I thought that my mum was going to be arrested for letting me watch the film. So I ran into her saying, "Mum, they're going to come and get you." You know, I was really scared of authority. So I didn't find the film scary. I just found Simon Bates scary. I was fine watching a 12 at 8 because I actually knew the difference between fiction and reality. And so I guess that was kind of my first experience, and that all, I started to think about that a lot when I was making Censor.
Whenever you rent or buy a video, you need to be sure that the film you choose is suitable for the audience at home. To help you, there are certificates given to films which tell you broadly what the film is like. This film has been classified 18, which means it's for adults only. It's an offence for your shop to supply an 18 video to anyone under that age, so don't ask them to break the law. An 18 film will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words. The video certificates are there to give you the chance to make an informed choice. They allow you to have peace of mind and be entertained. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the film.
You said a little bit earlier on, if these films have this effect on audiences, why don't they on censors? I remember having a conversation with Kim many years ago in which Kim said, Kim, I'm paraphrasing, you said, the only way I would believe in film censorship is if James Furman came out of a screening of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and immediately killed his secretary, then I would believe in the cause and effect of it. And I remember, you know, being very involved in those incredibly heated debates which happened. They began in the 80s, they carried on through into the 90s and through the amendment, the Public Order Act and all that stuff. So Kim, how did you get involved? Because obviously you are the person that someone would turn to on this subject.
I got involved because I know Prano. I contributed a certain something to her earlier short film on the subject, Nasty, in which I very briefly appear as a picture being arrested. Thank you very much. And she told me she was making this. I have to say, I now know what an executive producer does, which after all these years in the cinema business, I was a bit iffy on. And I know that my contribution has mostly been, I think, what we could call moral support. And after every cut I saw, I said, couldn't it be more violent? I remember saying that the something about the decapitations needed more head choppery stuff. But I was drawn into Prano's world. enormously proud of what she has achieved with this. First feature, I think it's an extraordinary work as well. But as I say, it's and here's another thing which is unique about this film. I can't review it.
You're credited on
unlike
it.
Unlike everything else, every other film I've seen, you'll never see a review from me about this. Except, of course, Prano has, because I sent her notes.
Firstly, I should say, Kim, that that's absolutely right, and it's completely correct that you shouldn't review a film that you are accredited consultant on. And I applaud you take it because obviously that's right. I mean, we all remember the problems that ensued when the BBC's film review show was presented by somebody who was very, very closely connected to one of the films that they were reviewing. And, you know, and they kind of had to get around it by saying, I have to say I have a connection, to which the answer is, well, don't do it then. But it is, it is. I mean, I remember once coming out at the end of the screening of Funny Man. And at the very, very end of the Funny Man credits, it says thanks to a whole bunch of people. And amongst those people is me and Nigel Floyd, for no reason other than that we'd gone on set to write about the film for Fangoria magazine. And I remember saying to Nigel, does that mean we can't review the film? And Nigel saying, I hope so. So, Prana, on the subject of, you know, censorship, and particularly around that time, if you are of my age and you remember the incredible sense of moral panic that was going on, one of the things that your film manages to get really on the nose is, although there's a kind of sense of, you know, chaos, when it comes to what the censors are doing, it's a really strange box-ticking affair of reduce hacking by 3 hacks, take down sight of bloody stump spurting blood by 1 stump. How did you research all that stuff?
Well, the first place we went, funnily enough, was the BBFC, who were really...
I imagine they were very helpful.
Really helpful, and I hope they like the film, because it represents their work, doesn't it, in so many ways. And it's such a unique job. You know, it's not like many people do this. And at the time, I think there were 9 film censors, you know, in the whole country. So Anthony Fletcher, who I co-wrote the script with, and I went to the BBFC, and David Hyman and Catherine Anderson talked to us there. And we were able to have a look at some of the files, and that was kind of our starting point. But then I did find film censors who'd worked at the time. So Carol Topolsky was one of the people I spoke to quite a lot, and was helpful as well. When we got to the rehearsal stages, she talked to Niamh about the role. So it was kind of like you write something and then you go and speak to somebody like that, and then you come back and you're always trying to get it kind of right in terms of making it as accurate as possible. But then obviously you're making a film, so, you know, you have to make it interesting as well.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that stands out is, obviously, the time that the film is set is in the height of the Furman years. The BBFC now is unrecognisable from the BBFC under James Furman. During the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, I think we all just had a constant battle with the BBFC. I think that ever since they basically changed at the end of the century, they have become, I think they are now the most open and accountable classification body anywhere in the world. But they were before dogged with this weird thing of having James Furman, who was absolutely in control of everything and was very, very concerned about what the media thought about everything, was very against letting journalists have access to files. I mean, even getting a straight answer about, is The Exorcist banned on video? I mean, it took me 6 years to get somebody in the BBFC to say, OK, officially, no, but actually, yes. And I think that the thing that the film does get right is that strange sense of almost like a cult, that group of censors. It's almost like a cult. Didn't you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, that's another... you've just given me a whole new idea for a film. You know, turn them into a cult. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just fascinating reading the way they looked at films. And one of my favourite files, obviously, having already mentioned The Evil Dead, was the file for The Evil Dead, because you read all the things they're saying about the film at the time, and then 8 years later or so, they revisit The Evil Dead that's been cut. It was never on the Video Nasty Band list, but it was heavily cut. And one of the same examiners is reacting, saying, I can't believe we reacted like this. But it was, you know, the atmosphere at the time was so paranoid. We were viewing these films in a totally different way. And I found that really interesting, that there was that kind of, you know, consciousness looking back at how the world around the censor's office was affecting, you know, the way they were looking at this work. So that was what we were always trying to balance with Enid, was, you know, how does your work change if you know, the world is telling you all this stuff. How is your reality shaped or your perception shaped by things like the media as well?
I fear that the only way to stop those possessed by the spirits of the book is through the act of bodily dismemberment.
I don't care what happens to her. She's your girlfriend, you take care of her.
The Evil Dead is a particular case for me because I was finally slipped the papers before they were kind of, you know, officially released. And I, as you quite rightly say, when it first came in, actually, Furman, I think, originally thought, well, we might be able to pass it uncut because he thought it was funny. But there was an examiner who said that they felt that they had been physically assaulted by it, and they ended up cutting quite a lot out of the version that was released. And yet, even after that, because it had got caught up in the video nasty scare, because there had been prosecutions, I mean, obviously at Snaresbrook, they famously won a case, but there were cases that they lost. The reason for ages it was unavailable was because they were terrified of passing something that had been caught up in all that. And I did an interview with Furman when they finally passed a second cut version, an even more cut version than the first cut version. And he used this phrase. He said, the difficult thing is trying to cut something that is designed to be over the top so that it's still over the top, but not that over the top. And that seemed to me to be kind of the perfect embodiment of what they were trying to do, which was impossible. And finally, years later, when it was finally passed uncut, it was Adam at Channel 4 who was finally responsible for the submission that got through. And I'm proud to say that in this office, I have the official uncut BBFC signed certificate for the first time. It was completely cleared, 18, because Adam, who did all the stuff at Film 4 and Extreme Cinema, was the person finally responsible for getting it through. But that idea of the world changing, what your film is about the central character changing because of what they see, which is a very kind of David Cronenberg Videodrome kind of idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is. And it's interesting to think about it like that, because it's always the tension when you make a film that's about someone viewing something and then them, are they being affected by what they're watching, or is it the real world that's affected them already? And I guess that's the kind of tension that we're playing with in the film. And I think because of that, it can be read in different ways. Some people are going to come away from the film and I did think some people might come away and go, oh, you know, horror films are so bad for us, which is fine. But, you know, hopefully people will see the wink in that as well. And other people will read something completely different that's more about trauma.
Cronenberg always said that the Videodrome for him was a film that said, what if the censors are right?
Yeah.
You know, what if it's true that if we watch this stuff, we will develop a VCR hole in our stomach and James Woods will end up being sucked into a television screen? And I always love that idea, which is let's create a reality that's actually based on the idea that the censors are right. Kim, presumably, were you offering advice about the recreation of those movies?
I mean, one of the things that I talked to Prano a bit about was, because there's an unusual circumstance in Censor for plot reasons, the film that Enid becomes obsessed with, or the filmmaker Enid becomes obsessed with, has to be British. And there weren't that many people in Britain making video nasties. I know, was it Killer's Moon is on the list, isn't it? Which is this really strange 70s film. And I remember pointing Prano to Extro, which was a low-budget British horror film made around that time, and a few of the other sort of really much more obscure British filmmakers who went out and did these sort of... Quite often they were people who normally made porn,
yeah,
who got bored with that and just wanted to make one slasher movie. And you've got these things that crept out on video. Or remember that movie made... Suffer Little Children, made by a stage school.
Yeah. Yes.
And I thought, you know, so I did, as I say, I pointed the way towards that kind of aesthetic for when we get to the film within a film. So Prano, how much more of that film did you write? I mean, could you actually now release a Frederick North film?
Maybe, if we went back through all the drafts, we might find a little bit more of Frederick North's film. But it's true.
Were you tempted to write the whole thing and just go out and shoot it over a weekend?
Felt that. I remember me and my editor, Mark Towns, whenever we'd be cutting things like Don't Go in the Church or Asunder, so the scene of the films within the film, we'd be like, oh, wouldn't it be great just to go out and make a Video Nasty, because he's a massive Video Nasty fan too. So yeah, there is the temptation, but there is a snippet of Frightmare in the title sequence. So it was tricky, because obviously most of those directors were sort of Italian, and but it would have been a different, it had to stay British.
And you did deliberately not reference real films. All the films that Enid looks at or even talks about are made up by you.
Yeah, and that
all the filmmakers.
That was a decision that we made when we made Nasty, the short film, because there's a number of factors in here. One is the obvious copyright factor, which is a boring factor. Two is the fact that the people like you guys who know about these films know every single detail. So if we were to put in, if we wanted to put The Evil Dead in Nasty and Nasty set in 1980, people are going to say, oh, well, that didn't have, that version wasn't out then, or, it wasn't cut like that. Or so it was kind of an avoidance of all these finickety facts that cult horror fans know inside out and will potentially pull them out of the story. But also because it's just so much fun to create fake titles, and it gives you a lot more creative leeway, I think, to be making this stuff up.
Because all your fake titles and fake films are quite convincing. I mean, they're not parodic in that kind of trauma way, are they? I mean, I believe that these films could exist.
Well, maybe that can be the DVD extras or the Blu-ray extras, the whole of Asunder.
It is also, I have to say, a really good idea to, to avoid, exactly as you're saying, to avoid the attentions of the nerdily inclined, because there was part of me that relaxed when I realised that was happening, because it was kind of, okay, you could sit back. You're in safe. They're not going to suddenly start saying this happened in that film. You're going to go, oh, well, actually, it didn't happen in that film. And actually, funnily enough, Kim and I have had this discussion before. One of the weird things about the Video Nasties list was it did make us all watch a bunch of films that otherwise we really probably would have struggled to find the time to get through. I mean,
I've seen I Miss You, Hugs and Kisses, which is a title that's on the Video Nasties list, presumably because somebody in some video shop somewhere thought that it was going to be, I don't know, a romantic film. And it turns out to be a film with one scene of violence. And otherwise, it's a very ordinary, rather dull melodrama. But I've watched it purely because somebody once called it a Video Nasty.
2 months ago, Charles Krushen, millionaire husband of former model Magdalene Krushen, offered a $10,000 reward for information leading to the capture of his wife's murderer. Today, through a dramatic turn of events, Krushen himself has been charged with the brutal slaying of his wife, Magdalene Krushen, who was found bludgeoned to death in her home. Charles Krushen, her husband, was charged with the murder and later released on a $100,000 bond.
Why would I want to kill her when, obviously, divorce is the sensible way out?
All she is a money-grubbing little nothing.
It's not 24, it's $27,000 with all the extras,
Goddamn little whore.
Well, the weird thing is that the so-called Big 60 list, which was actually 72 anyway, and it appeared in the monthly film bulletin, which was the
I printed
that long list. Okay, so that list, I never know why it's referred to as the Big 60, because it's 70 anyway. That list, which included the titles on what was then later referred to as the Video Nasty list, and then, as you quite rightly say, a whole bunch of titles when the police had gone in. And it impounded a bunch of titles. And quite often what would happen with video dealers is that they would just say, okay, fine, we won't contest it. We'll just take a, and then every single title that was impounded was then listed as an impoundable title.
But the list that we ran in the monthly film bulletin, actually a journalist friend of mine got from the DPP, and it was the list that went to the police who were raiding video shops. And the thing about it, it was just a typewritten list of titles. There was nothing to say, under Death Trap. It didn't say, make sure it's Toby Hooper's Death Trap, Michael Caine film, Christopher Reeve. And it was full of things like that, and some of the titles were slightly wrong. And in fact, I mean, when we were doing that piece for the monthly film bulletin, it was me and Julian Petley, who's another big researcher of the era. We actually had to look at these things and check. And I think there's one case where we just completely failed to see what the film that the this was referring to was. I think it was like The Beast. We assumed it was the Borowczyk film, and it turned out not to be that. It's a Nazi film called The Beast in Heat. So that's one of those cases where what we published was full of gaps and says subject to further research. And we were like actually committed film researchers. You can't expect your average plod who's been told, just go down the video shop and haul off their shelves. any of these films. You can't expect them to. And so you had those things where people would, the police would go in and get Cannibal Apocalypse and Apocalypse Now mixed up. And we all laugh at that. But frankly, if it's not your job primarily, if you don't spend much time going to movies or whatever, and the police were much more interested in the under the counter porn than the horror films that were out there on display.
I loved the story about that they released that statistic that was it sort of 7 in 10 primary school children have watched these video nasties. So somebody went out with a list of fake video nasty titles and interviewed all these school kids, and they were like, oh yeah, I've watched that, because no one wanted to look like they hadn't seen the scary film in front of their mates. I just thought that sums it up in so many ways.
I mean, but the other thing about that time was, of course, Martin Barker published the book The Video Nasties, and I remember him writing at the beginning of it saying, this is a discussion taking place in occupied territory. And actually, by the time the book was out, I think the Video Recordings Act had already been barreled through, because originally there was a whole thing about self-regulation, which looked like it could do it, but then it did get barreled through. But writing about that stuff at the time was considered to be, you could get the tabloid journalists could get on your back. I mean, academics or people who were serious saying, actually, I think some of these movies are defensible, would find tabloid journalists on, doorstepping them.
And I think we all at some point, went on one of those annoying Channel 4 debate programs where there'd be a whole room full of people and there'd be like some sort of censorship campaign, pro-campaigners. There were like people from the Festival of Light who'd never seen any of the films. And then there would be the sort of the really difficult ones. There would be like somebody who had had someone in their family be a victim of a crime, who then was going to try and blame it on. And it's like you're trying to be sympathetic to someone who's had a horrible, horrible experience. You think, well, there are other reasons for crime. And then there'd always be somebody dressed up as an executioner at the back or something, because they always would like haul the most kind of eccentric horror films. I think you can find on YouTube lots of clips of me and Alan Jones and Stephanie Wharton and Ann Bilson suffering through these long, agonizing evenings.
They've been a staple diet of my research, actually, just watching that stuff.
And I have to take all credit to Mark, because he stuck with it longer than I did. It's like they got to be a point where I would get phoned up and they would say, would you like to come onto our program to discuss censorship? And I'd say, frankly, no. It's like I feel I have said everything I want to say on this subject. You're not going to change my mind, but I know I'm also not going to change anyone else's.
But you also, as far as I remember, you said, frankly, no, but here's Mark Kermode's phone number.
Yeah, that's I also did that. And as you say, Martin said that thing about occupied territory. But here's the thing. What happened it was an armistice, not a victory at the end, the Video Recordings Act. It didn't actually solve
anything,
any of these issues. And it took years to get to something approaching a reasonable situation. And what in the end broke the dam wasn't like some huge change of mind on the part of the censorious who'd moved on to other things that they were now annoyed about. What changed their minds was the internet, was suddenly access to visual material from all around the world became so much easier. And it's like, you think of the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dam, in the hole in the dam, surrounded by thousands of other leaks. And it's like the struggle to stay abreast of the sort of maelstrom of information out there has rendered the, you know, the job of censor kind of sort of almost quaint in its strange old-fashioned term. And of course, it's the job of classifier now, and the thing is, I fully approve of that, and I 100% support the notion of classifying films and at least regulating some form of what people are exposed to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This depiction is dangerous.
Come on, Enid. No one's going to pick this up and think it's a documentary. It's so fake.
To you, it might be sausages for intestines, but what if it gets into the hands of children?
Exactly.
Kids could be rewinding and watching those scenes over and over again.
Which is exactly what new government guidelines are pointing at. Video technology is
changing
the rules.
More guidelines. Great.
Not as if we haven't got enough on our hands.
How can we do our job properly if we're constantly bogged down by government bureaucracy?
It's the nation's sanity they're worried about. Why don't they stop slashing social services?
OK, I get it. But I'm afraid we're not here to debate the government. Can we get back on track, please? Consensus on cannibal carnage.
Reject.
I agree. Few cuts. I'd pass it.
Enid.
Prano, let me ask you, in terms of making sense, I love the soundtrack of it. I love the way the film sounded. I mean, everything from the sound design to the way in which you've used the music. And I think I sent you a message after I'd seen it, immediately asking, where can I get hold of this and what is that? So tell me about the sound design of the film, because that's so important to the feel of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of think in sound when I'm writing. So there were a lot of elements of sound that were kind of written into the script. And one of my ways into thinking about the censor's office soundscape was Watership Down, which is quite a weird inspiration for a film like this. But, well, maybe not. It's also, you know, it's pretty violent. But the inspiration was really the Rabbit Warrens and this idea of, you know, the censors being almost in like a version of the Rabbit Warrens, they're underground, but instead of the whispers of other voices of rabbits coming down the corridors, it's the screams of people dying in films in the rooms next door. So I was always talking about this and my sound designer, Tim Harrison, and I have worked on a lot of my earlier projects together. So I was talking to Tim about all this stuff, and he actually, in it, before we even started shooting the film, he went off and he makes music as well. So he designed the soundscape and scores for, I don't know, a handful of maybe 20 or more fake Video Nasty titles. So he sort of sent me all this stuff, and he made little films, like visual films for them as well. And they're called things like Brain Splitters and Run Rabbit Run. They've all got names. And so we kind of had this body of films to kind of pick and choose from. And then, you know, when Emily Levanese Farouche, the composer, came on board, I immediately brought her and Tim together, because for me, it's like a collaboration, you know, sound and music. And we were always talking about how could we, is there a way to overlap any sounds? And is there a way for, you know, certain elements to become part of the music and things like that? So they collaborated amazingly together. And Emily went and spent some time at Tim's studio. He's got lots of like classic old original synths and things that we used. But the challenge, I guess, with the music was always, when you're making a film set during this period that's about these films, how much do you lean into the style of that era, you know? And we always wanted to kind of have a nod towards it, but for it not to take over the film, because otherwise, again, you're kind of pulled out of Enid's story. So, you know, there could be a version of the soundtrack that's like very Carpenter-esque, but when Emily kind of first sent me a piece of her music and we put it to picture, it just felt like she'd kind of tuned into Enid's trauma in this incredible way. She used her voice for a lot of it, and her process is to watch the film over and over and over again and kind of tune into the lead character and then almost turn that into the music. So she's just so clever, so talented. So she was sending us this stuff that just drew us into Enid's journey, and then we were looking at, like, how do we, you know, bring alive the kind of era without pulling us away from that emotional sort of journey of the character.
I love her work. I mean, I've played her work on Scala many times beforehand, and I was delighted to see that she was doing this. And after I watched the film, I got in touch with her and said, look, can you send me the score? Because it's not been released yet. And she said, well, I can do it privately. I can send you a, you know, and I was listening to it and thinking it is a brilliant example of how the film comes from the sound up, which, you know, for so many of us, that is how you experience film. Also, there is a brilliant use of this piece of music by Blank Mass. I sent you a message saying, this is driving me nuts. This is absolutely, where have I heard that piece of music before? And quite coincidentally, Blank Mass's score for Calm with Horses was my favourite film score of last year. And you said, oh, well, it's this piece. So tell me about that piece and where somebody might have heard it before.
So the track is called Chernobyl, and someone may have heard it on a Ben Wheatley film before. But when I was writing Censor, there was one weekend where I just discovered that album, and I literally sat and had that album on repeat and was just writing the film. And it was, again, it's like you kind of find a way into a project sometimes through different things. And like with the Censor's Office and Watership Down, like there was something about writing the end and the kind of weird, beautiful expansiveness of that track that just takes you to another planet. And again, it's one of those things that you just put it with the imagery and it was kind of glued together. So that's used at a certain point. And I mean, it's an immense track.
It is. It's immense. It's absolutely immense, and it's perfectly chosen. And just Tell me something about your cast. I mean, obviously, you know, Nevy's so brilliant. So tell me about casting the central roles.
Yeah, I mean, me and Neve actually met before we met in the audition room. So we were on the Screen International Stars of Tomorrow, the same kind of year group. So we actually met there, and I never knew that this was going to be the person who'd become Enid, which is kind of weird looking back at it now. But we'd sort of started the casting process, and I've got these notes from pre-casting that I'd written down that were things like, we need to find someone we can't look away from. And, you know, because ultimately whoever played Enid needed to carry the whole film, because you're in her head and you're in someone's head, but that person isn't expressing themselves clearly. You know, she doesn't, as a character, she's not hugely open. I mean, we tried to kind of embody the idea of censorship within this character. So she's emotionally very censored, but at the same time, she's reading information through the film in a very specific way, and we need the audience to be with that person. So I was really looking for somebody who could, you know, bring that nuance and that clarity, I guess, to the performance, but also someone we just can't stop looking at. And then Neve came in and basically was that person. And I think it was the moment that I was like, yes, with her, was when she read this scene. And I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give too much away, but on paper, it's a very emotional scene. And on paper, it was just one line. And Neve just, I couldn't believe where she went with it emotionally, you know, because you need somebody who's going to be this kind of coiled spring, very kind of repressed at the beginning, but emotionally where they go is very extreme. And she was just able to take us on that journey. But also is just such a lovely person. So, you know, you're working with an actor in every single scene. Pretty much she's in every single scene except for when it's her younger self. Having somebody like Neve to work with, who was just hilarious when the camera stopped rolling, she'd kind of come out and just keep me sort of sane with her hilarious madness. It was brilliant to work with her. Amazing.
I saw some photographs of you on set, and I didn't recognise her because she's smiling in them. Yeah. And it's like, in her whole career, I don't think I've ever seen her smile.
But yeah. It's remarkable because, I mean, obviously, you know, she's so brilliant in Calm with Horses, and she is such a great performer, not least because she looks completely different from role to role.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, this is what actors do. They inhabit different people. You know, in America, they call them character actors, and here we call them actors, because that's what you do. You inhabit the role. But I thought she did a really brilliant job of giving you the sense that she's keeping everything within. It's a, you know, she's not telegraphing the stuff. She's keeping it within, because that's, you know, her job and her personal life is all to do with just keeping everything, you know, down. As you said before, it's about, you know, it's about trauma and the return of the repressed and, you know, all that stuff, which horror fans love to talk about at great length. Kim, from your point of view, this is your first exec producer credit?
Yes. Yeah. It's like I have like contractual credits on a whole bunch of projects, because when you sell rights to things, they always say, oh, we'll make you a producer as well. This is the first time I've ever actually had any involvement in anything which was not out of my head, as it were.
And you must be very, very proud of the result, because the thing.
Oh, extraordinarily! Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I wouldn't have agreed to take to sign up this project if I didn't believe it in the first place. I've followed Prano's work for some years now, and I hope I've been a supporter of
it massively.
From her earlier short films. I mean, I think in fact I met you because I'd seen a short film of yours, isn't it? And you came to a party.
Yeah, you selected Short Lease, which was a film, I think I made it in 2010, and you selected it for the Critics' Choice It was like the Critics' Choice in Film Festival in Prague, and then you invited me and the co-director Jennifer Ice. We came to your party, and then you have been massively supportive, like throughout all of. He's a good guy.
And Prano, what does it mean to the film to have Kim's name attached to it?
Well, I mean, it's huge for you know, right from the offset. I mean, Kim says, you know, he's just said, but he didn't know what this film would be at the point when he came on board as an exec, because we hadn't even written a draft. He kind of put his name to it, and that because of the subject matter. You know, and like you say, I wasn't around then, apart from as a tiny, tiny person. It's like a incredibly valuable stamp of approval, and also like an encyclopedic knowledge of this period that you can sort of, you know, go and say, hey, Kim, you know, what about this, or what about, you know, so not just in terms of just having somebody like Kim's name attached to the project, but also the advice along the way and everything. It's really,
and I have like made you watch films. I think that's my main contribution.
Kim introduced me to one of my favorite horror films, Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which I made Niamh watch in preparation for this.
Paramount Pictures presents Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
Who killed that man?
What man?
I don't know. He was lying right here, but I swear it's true. I think that the same creature or whatever it is that killed the antique dealer killed them all.
I think you should go back to New York for a while.
I mean, obviously, it's a Censor is a very different film, but this idea of
I own the Censor certificate from Let's Get
Jessica. Here we go. Remember. Yeah.
Which, if you remember, because Mark actually interviewed me at that. It was an event to launch the latest edition of Nightmare Movies, where Mark interviewed me and we showed Let's Get Jessica.
Yeah.
And a guy who worked at Paramount came and gave me the the certificate, which I thought was a really sweet gesture. It's framed and it's up in my kitchen.
Yeah.
But I remember we saw Dead of Night together as well. That's another really interesting older horror film. Yeah. So I feel that's partly, my job is to
take me and I'm
to make you watch depressing films.
Oh, it's one of my favourite things to do already, but I get to do it with Kim Newman now. But I'm looking forward to going to the cinema with you again.
Yes, no, that's right. That's one thing we've all missed. You know, certainly I've missed. Yeah.
Well, look, to both of you, congratulations. I mean, I think the film's just great. I mean, I know we're only in whatever it is, February, but it's one of my favourite films of the year. I guarantee you, by the time we get to the end of the year, it's going to be in my top films list. When can people in the UK see it? Does it have a UK distributor?
We are in the process right now of signing pieces of paper, so I can't say at this stage, but hopefully the news will be out soon, possibly by the time the podcast is out.
And do you have any idea when we might, because already I'm getting, I mean, I know obviously, but people are saying, when can I see this, because it did create quite a splash at Sundance.
Well, the next stop for the film is the Berlin Film Festival, which is really exciting. So that's now the audience facing part of that is in June. And I don't want to say too much at this stage about when it might be appearing in the UK, because we don't know for sure yet. But I really hope it's not going to be too long for people over here.
Yeah, we also don't know if there will be cinemas or if there will be a UK. But, you know, so it's all contingent on that.
That small matter.
Well, you know, I mean, I can't wait for people to get the chance to see it.
But I have seen a version on a big screen. And I think that it's going to be a film that will actually have an impact on people if they see it in a cinema. I think it works really well as a kind of home experience because it's sort of intimate and creepy. But I think seeing it with a crowd is going to be quite something.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to people being able to see it, not least because it means I can actually talk to them about it. But congratulations, Prado. It's great, and I'm not just saying. I mean, I asked you to come on the podcast because I loved it, and believe me, if I hadn't, I wouldn't have invited you on. And Kim knows as well that you know what my reaction was, Kim, because I got straight in touch with you. I mean, I just love it. I think it's really something, and congratulations to both of you, and I can't wait for other people to see it because it's an exceptional piece of work. So
thank you so
much.
Yeah,
we're going to be talking about this film all year.
We are, yeah, and that's the thing. We are going to be talking about it all year, which is why I want people to see it. Whenever the time is ready. Kim Prano, thank you so much. Congratulations very much on the movie. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you've enjoyed this, you can go to the Patreon page and you can see a video of us, me, in my shoe cupboard, Prano in a very nicely organised room, and Kim, well, in the room of bookshelves. And remember, tell your friends, subscribe, do all the usual stuff. Thanks ever so much for listening. And come back next week. Keep watching this, guys. Take care. Thanks. Bye.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.